This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 21st, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 174. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, the Is It Just Me commentary, I Award a Virtual Nanaimo Bar to a Difference Maker, and the big deal feature, the 24th Vancouver International Mountain Film Festival presented by Arc'teryx is on now until February 28th. I speak to the directors and subjects of two of the films, Beyond the Break and Eastbound. Now, Is It Just Me? Is it just me, or does Prime Minister Justin Trudeau really have a hard time saying the word genocide? Back in June 2019, he reluctantly agreed that missing and murdered Indigenous women suffered genocide.
We accept the finding that this was genocide, and we will move forward to end this ongoing national tragedy.
But in February 2021, he waffled when asked if China is committing genocide against Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang.
It's a word that is extremely loaded and is certainly something that we should be looking at in the case of the Uyghurs. And I know the international community is looking very carefully at that, and we are certainly among them, and we will not hesitate from being part of the determinations around these sorts of things.
The world is slowly waking up to the reality that the next Winter Olympics are scheduled for February 2022 in China, where a genocide is taking place. All the boxes are ticked by the Chinese Communist Party. Kidnapping, jailing, brainwashing, rape, sterilization. There is enough proof from international media, human rights groups, and victims themselves. Human rights groups are calling for a boycott of the Beijing 2022 Olympics, which are being compared to Hitler's Berlin 1936 Games. Conservative leader Aaron O'Toole says, move the Olympics out of China. There is not enough time for the IOC to move the games, but there is still time for athletes to refuse to go to China. That is where Canada can take the lead. When the West boycotted the Moscow 1980 Olympics, athletes from 29 countries competed in the Liberty Bell Track and Field Classic in Philadelphia. Which got me thinking, Canada's athletes of ice and snow could boycott Beijing, invite the world to do the same, and host an alternative event in Vancouver, Whistler, and Calgary. A festival of skating, skiing, sledding, hockey, and curling. It could reintroduce 2010 host Vancouver and 1988 host Calgary to the world at a time when the tourism industry needs a boost. Xi Jinping could still have his party for the few countries that go, and the IOC bigwigs could enjoy their perks. Meanwhile, athletes of the world could make a bold statement in support of human rights for all. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Apple Daily, Hong Kong population drops for first time in 17 years. There were 7.47 million residents at the end of last year, a decrease of more than 46,000 from 2019. The drop included some 50,000 who left the city for good, which was a 10-year high, although it was partly offset by more than 10,000 migrants settling in the city from mainland China. The last time the population recorded a net decrease was in 2003, when an outbreak of severe acute respiratory syndrome took a heavy toll on the local economy and killed almost 300 people. ABC News Australia. From UK COVID hotspot to Texas ice storm, desperate Australian couple scrambles to find a way home. Sarah Reynolds Ryan and husband Jackson are some of the thousands of Australians stranded overseas since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. Reynolds Ryan's mother in Victoria is demanding answers from the federal government. The couple is in the US after their flight from the UK to Melbourne was cancelled due to the lockdown. Homeless and jobless, they could find no alternative flights to Australia before April.
Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Salem Reporter, Enchanted Forest, a disaster area after ice storm, still hopes to reopen March 19th. The Kitty Train was completely crushed under a fallen tree. Ice Mountain, bobsleds, and Big Timber Log Ride are both covered in fallen trees that will have to be carefully removed to prevent causing further damage. Good news, some of the more iconic figures in the park, such as Humpty Dumpty and the Witch's Head, are intact. The English Village and Toffville Western Town are also largely unscathed. So is the Challenge of Mondor. In the Seattle Times, the 89-year-old walking man of Seattle's South Lake Union closes in on 20,000 miles through a changing city. Bill Hoppen, yeah, that's his name, started walking and tracking his mileage in February 2011 after his son Steve gave him a GPS watch. If the average mile equals 2,000 steps, then Hoppen has walked 40 million steps, not just through Seattle. 65 years ago, when he was in the Army, he ran all the time and skied. Then he took up golfing and had a 3 handicap, but over time he had to give each of those things up for reasons of health and pride. In the Delta Optimist, Point Roberts residents exempt from COVID testing at border. The Canadian government agreed with Washington Governor Jay Inslee. They can travel to the Blaine border crossing without meeting the Canadian requirement for a test. The border has been closed to non-essential travel since last March, greatly impacting many Point Roberts businesses that rely on Canadian customers. Meanwhile, BC owners of vacation properties are also frustrated. They haven't been able to access their homes in nearly a year. A Point Roberts COVID-19 vaccination clinic could commence as early as next week. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. The Vancouver International Mountain Film Festival is back for 2021, but with a twist. To enjoy the 24th annual edition presented by Arc'teryx, go to vimff.org. It's all online because of the pandemic. One of the world premiere films is Beyond the Break, the Sam Daniels story. It's a documentary by Missy McIntosh. It follows multi-sport athlete Sam Daniels, who competed at the Vancouver 2010 Paralympics in alpine skiing. Sam's life changed in 2005 when he suffered a spinal cord injury and paralysis in a mountain biking crash. He's a cyclist, snowmobiler, paraglider, and now a surfer.
I remember that first wave.
The feeling of being lifted by it and then dropping off the backside of it. I'd never quite felt anything like that, and I remember being like, wow, that is just like incredible power. I would love to go to the store and get the board I want, but that store doesn't exist. I think I've done a really good job in life of not having my injury define who I am.
Woo!
We all have an ability to do some pretty amazing things. I can't change my injury, but I get to decide what I can do with my injury.
Joining me from East Vancouver is filmmaker Missy McIntosh, and from North Vancouver, Sam Daniels.
How did this production come about?
I work primarily for a company called Pink Buffalo Films and True Calling Media. True Calling Media does short, sort of 5 minutes and under kind of featurettes featuring people who love what they do, whether it's their jobs or their hobbies or whatever their passion is, just really short, bite-sized, inspirational content to make people sort of rethink and reassess and kind of motivate them to pursue what they love to do. And a colleague of mine knew Sam and said, hey, I know this guy who's making adaptive surfboards. And so I went out to meet Sam about filming one of these sort of short documentaries. And it was very clear on meeting Sam that we needed more than 5 minutes to devote to his story and kind of the cool work that he was doing. So that's where it all came from.
But what does it mean to be in this film festival, which has this international reputation?
Yeah, I've been born and raised in Vancouver and have always known of VIMF and always sort of paid attention. And it feels pretty surreal, actually, to have my very first doc feature be premiering at VIMF. So it's a dream come true for me. And, you know, as much as I would love to do sort of the in-person whole festival experience, you know, that would be a total dream. I'm also really happy that it is online because I feel like we're just able to give more people access to the film, which is great. I think there's a lot of great things that people can take away from this story, especially about sort of accessibility and adaptive gear and the power of being outside and playing in nature and how important that is. And so I'm happy that it's online at VIMF to get those messages out.
Sam, this documentary isn't only about you surfing, but actually making your own board. Talk about why you decided to make your own board and how you learned to make your own board.
The decision to make my own board came about because, it's sort of tied into how I was introduced to surfing in the first place. An old teammate of mine from the skiing days invited me to go out to Tofino with a group of his friends, and he had sort of gotten into this group of guys who were sort of getting adaptive surfing off the ground up here in Canada. And he invited me to go along for that. And I had some really, really bad gear that had been gifted to me, and it was completely inadequate. While I was on this little trip, we had zero opportunity to surf because it was about 40 feet of swell. It was total storm watching weather in Tofino. So unfortunately we got completely skunked, but we did have an opportunity to go around the sheltered side of the peninsula there and paddle around. And I did get an opportunity to sit in a board made by a guy in California who was building adaptive surfboards for people that, and these boards were at a decent level in terms of their fit and function. I knew that there was something so much better than the thing that I had been gifted. And I tried to get this guy to build me one, but he just was busy. He just wasn't motivated, shall we say, to actually get down and build it for me. So I did a little bit of research, and I actually found out that there was a sort of community-based co-op that would teach you how to build surfboards in Vancouver called Shaper Studios. And I wandered in there, and I basically explained my story and showed them pictures of the gear that I had. And they were kind of like, yeah, I mean, we've never seen one, but you know, we could probably more or less teach you how to build this thing. So I built a couple of regular stand-up surfboards first, just to get a handle on the tools and the materials and what the process would be like. And then I just went for it. I scoured the internet for photos of every one of these adaptive surfboards that I could find to try and get inspiration in terms of all the elements of design that I wanted to implement into it. And then it came time to sort of go through the process. I built some templates and cut some blocks of foam and whittled them down. And I think the first one took me over 100 hours of actual hands-on building. It was very tedious. And then it was done. And I still have that board to this day. It's still like my workhorse. Yeah.
Now with the sport of surfing, Sam, you've competed in the Paralympics in skiing. This year, if the Olympics do happen, fingers crossed, in Tokyo, it'll be the launch of surfing in the Olympics, which naturally means that surfing will get much more worldwide attention. Movies about surfing, documentaries about surfing should be able to also benefit. And your story is going to get out there naturally and possibly, hopefully, inspire others to all kinds of abilities to surf. What do you think about this opportunity that surfing has to get a greater global audience and global perspective?
I think the more people that are responsibly playing in the ocean, going surfing, and gaining a connection there, the ocean is so powerful. And when people are able to sort of get in and actually interact with it, I think they're far more likely to realize also how fragile it is and how much there is to take care of there. You know, there's a ton of environmental problems, and the ocean is sort of at the brunt of many of them. The ocean really regulates our Earth in so many ways. So I think at the core of answering your question, I hope that people gain more awareness to want to protect our shorelines and our oceans. In terms of every individual, I don't know many people who come out of the water surfing who don't feel better than before they went in. So I think it, in a funny way, makes our world a better place just the same, because happy people are better people generally. So I think there's so many benefits to more participation. And I think that we'll only continue to see those benefits as time goes on. More people doing it, having more fun, creates a better community, creates better advocacy and a better voice to take care of our planet and
keep everybody happy. And if I can just jump in, I really hope that this shines a light on how hard it is to get adaptive gear, especially adaptive surfboards. The fact that Sam can't go to a store and just buy one, like anyone who isn't a wheelchair user. I really hope that this means that boards will become more available and other types of adaptive gear will be more available. And Sam's actually starting to make surfboards for other people who are dealing with spinal cord injuries and life-changing injuries. So he's really like giving that gift of being able to surf to other people in similar situations to him.
Yeah, I think about the total amount of fun that I've had surfing. And how if it hadn't been introduced to me, there would have been that much less fun in my life and that much less joy in my life. And I think about, you know, a surfboard is just a chunk of foam and fiberglass. There's not much more to it. It's just a particular shape of foam and fiberglass. But as a tactical piece of equipment, it can bring so much joy to people. And I think about how building these for other people and handing them off, and how life-changing that can be for people.
How did surfing help you evolve in sporting pursuits and in life?
I think surfing is a great medium to teach a lot of very important lessons in life. One is patience. You know, you can't, it's not like going skiing where you sort of hop on the chairlift. It takes you 6 or 8 or 12 minutes to get to the top and then you come back down. And, you know, between 9 a.m. and 4 p.m., you do as many runs as you want. You're really on Mother Nature's schedule and you have to sort of acknowledge that. And I think from that acknowledgement comes a lot of lessons that you can apply to the rest of your life where you sort of realize that there are opportunities and they're constantly coming and they're constantly going. And some opportunities are great. Some opportunities aren't so great. You have to be patient, learn to pick which ones are important to you. There's a lot of lessons you can learn from being in the water. I jokingly tell people that the first lesson that surfing told me was that I can hold my breath a lot longer than I thought I could.
That was Missy McIntosh, director of Beyond the Break, and Sam Daniels, the subject of Missy's documentary. It's making its world premiere at the Vancouver International Mountain Film Festival. Making its North American premiere at the festival is Eastbound, Jenny Graham's Round the World Adventure by director Thomas Hogman. In 2018, Jenny Graham went from Berlin to Berlin on her bike in 124 days. That's 20 days faster than the world record. It took her through 15 countries, including Canada. Joining me from Scotland to talk about the adventure and the film are Guinness World Record holder Jenny Graham and filmmaker Thomas Hogman.
Just like you were going through a lot of peaks and valleys, there must have been the high days, the low days. What were some of the days, the tougher days on the journey, the days you may have had doubts about yourself? And how did you overcome those doubts and those challenges? What were some of the days that stick out as those bumps in the road?
The really tough days when the weather was horrendous or you had a huge headwind or you were climbing a massive mountain, they weren't the hard days because you could get your teeth into it. You knew why it was hard. It was more the daily grind when there was just a little bit of wind. It might have just been a wee bit drizzly and maybe the tarmac wasn't very nice. And it was just like this collection of little things that were making your day a little bit tougher, but there was no big thing that you could tick off and say, oh, that's why it's tough. So that sometimes the daily grind could get you down. But you know, I was so lucky out there every single day. Of course there was tough times without a doubt, but every single day I had a piece of that day that I was so delighted that I was there and doing what I was doing, and just the privilege of being able to spend 4 months of my life doing that and having this incredible team back home that had supported me getting to that start line, you know, and that community that all got behind me, like that never left me. So even when times were tough, you were like, well, of course it's tough because I'm cycling around the world. And that is a little bit tough, but actually I'm so lucky to be here.
Now, you went through Siberia and Mongolia, which are very tough environments. Not much pavement there, as I experienced when I was in Mongolia in 2007. And then, of course, you also went to Alaska and Yukon, which are in some ways similar, long open spaces, wildlife. Compare and contrast, the Siberia and Mongolia leg with the Alaska and Yukon leg.
Yeah, I'm really glad you've made that connection because I feel that they are very, very similar. There's the language barrier in Siberia that made it a little bit tougher. And it was very, very warm. You know, I was crossing the Gobi Desert out in Mongolia, so it was really hot. So like temperatures were different. But in terms of the culture and the warmth of the people and the curiosity of the people and this big open expanses that you were crossing, yeah, very similar. So yeah, I had the heat out there, and the language definitely made it tougher on the first leg. Not being able to connect with people in the same way. But then by the time I got to Canada, I was so tired that actually connecting with people was really, really difficult. So maybe I should have done it the other way around and had everyone to speak to in the first bit when it was a bit more bright and breezy. But yeah, I mean, coming down from Alaska and down the Yukon, what a treat, an absolute treat. I mean, I was petrified of bears, obviously. I'm sure that every cycle tourists that comes out there, you know, are, but I definitely, because I was so tired, then that I was being irrational about the bears and about bear movement around me and stuff, you know, when actually it probably wasn't the case. But yeah, they were very similar, and actually they're the two places out of everywhere I went to that I was like, I am coming back here with my family, I'm taking people back here, this is the most incredible place. Coming down from Alaska, when you just come into the Yukon at Beaver Creek, and then you just come in, that whole section was just like, I kept stopping my bike and looking around and just being like lost in the vastness of this area. Yeah, it was incredibly beautiful.
And along the way, there must have been times when you needed to fix the bike, tires, any of your own gear. Was there any time when you felt, besides the bears, unsafe or need assistance of strangers that sticks out in your mind as one of those highlights where you had a mechanical difficulty, something else was wrong, and a stranger was there to help and keep it going? A stranger at the right time.
Do you know who's my big saviors going around the world? Was local bike shops. Oh man, they just welcomed me. I went to 8 bike shops altogether and just arrived in the biggest mess you can imagine, gave them no warning, just like bike needed, you know, would need lots of stuff done to it. I clearly needed lots of coffee and something to eat. And they just dropped whatever they were doing, took me in, found the parts that I needed, just, you know, made sure that I was resting and had food, and just unbelievably kind. And you know, they were definitely the people that were there at the right time. Actually, when I came through Alaska and Palmer, a road just out of Anchorage, and I arrived in Palmer and the bike shop was closed, and the owner found me in the car park looking really lost, and you know, I'd have to wait there for a whole day if he hadn't sort of come along and found me. And he opened up his bike shop and he called his mechanic, who had the bit on his bike that I needed for my bike, and he did a swap around and they got me pizza. It was just unbelievable. Yeah, bike shops, a lot to be said for local bike shops.
And Thomas, talk about documenting this journey, around the world journey yourself. What challenges did you face as a filmmaker, and how did you overcome those challenges on this kind of journey?
The biggest challenge, obviously, was the fact that we, for more than one reason, we didn't join Jenny on the way, on the trip round, because the appeal, I guess, of the journey was that Jen had her own set of rules around what she would allow and wouldn't allow for the journey, and being on her own was a big part of that journey. So for us to have kind of tagged along, even if there was budget to allow us to do that, would have been against those rules in a way, because it was the experience of achieving that on our own that made this such a special challenge. But in saying that, that obviously makes it very hard to document the journey when you can't be there to do it. So we ended up just joining Jen at the start. And then when she came back into Europe, in Spain, France, and back to Germany, and then we had another camera crew pick her up in New Zealand and in Australia as well, to grab some little bits. And the rest, Jen just documented herself on her phone as well. And I mean, you've heard Jen speak. She's so enthusiastic and so positive. The biggest challenge we faced was getting across how hard the challenge was, because the materials, she's so upbeat and so positive about everything that showing the lows as well as the highs becomes difficult, because there's just so many highs throughout all of the journey as well. So yeah, it was a big challenge. I mean, we ended up with hundreds of hours of footage. Everything Jen took went up onto Dropbox, synced up to Dropbox, and we could take it down at our end and work away as we went. But it's a big journey, you know, it's a really big journey. And to try to distill that down into something that's exciting and engaging and thoughtful and poetic is a big task to do. So yeah, that's, I would say that's the biggest challenge, is not being there to tease those little pieces out is difficult. But I think it's what also gives the film its charm, because it is raw Jen on tap that you get from that self-shot footage.
So what are you shooting next?
Well, we're in pre-production on another feature based in Scotland that's exploring the sport of shinty, which is a very iconic sport within Scotland, and looking at how that the sport itself is changing just now. It's such a incredibly kind of visceral and also violent sport that in the modern day has a lot of limitations being pushed on it in certain ways, and it has such a special place with communities across the Highlands. It really does shape young men and women's lives in really dramatic ways. So we're working on a feature exploring that and the impact that it has within communities just now, as well as collaborating on a number of other short pieces too. The film industry in Scotland is really becoming alive again post-COVID, and is becoming more and more of a destination as well for both features, dramas, and documentaries too. So there's a whole bunch in the pipeline, and we're just lucky that the snow is just clearing here, and we'll be able to get out and shoot some stuff soon. So yeah, again, looking forward to it. Good year ahead, and lots of things coming.
That was Jenny Graham and Thomas Hogben joining me from Scotland. You can see Eastbound, Jenny Graham's Round the World Adventure by Thomas Hogben, as part of the Vancouver International Mountain Film Festival. Go to vimff.org. The online festival ends February 28th.
Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to seniors care providers across British Columbia, because February 23rd is BC Seniors Care Providers Day. It has been a difficult year for seniors in care and for the people who care for them. Nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 21st, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on February 21st in 1972, U.S. President Richard Nixon visits Chairman Mao in the People's Republic of China? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to Bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.